Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? The demand for post-colonial nations to pay reparations to their former colonies has grown increasingly loud over the last 20 years. Once upon a time, this was a minority pursuit, the cause of just a tiny handful of activists who were, it's fair to say, considered to be obsessives or fanatics. It's now discussed seriously by mainstream thinkers and even by some public and political figures. That doesn't mean it's discussed, let alone received, positively, of course. Most public figures who talk about reparations do so primarily to dismiss the idea. And frankly, these are often the more balanced responses, at least when you compare them with some commentators and tabloids for whom the whole subject is self-evidently a spasm of liberal guilt and bandwagon wokery. The issue, however, cannot be dismissed that easily. After all, if the British claim pride at the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade, and we certainly did claim pride during the 200th anniversary in 2007, it would be rather hypocritical if we didn't also recognise the shame and the guilt of the 150 years of slavery that preceded it and that made abolition necessary in the first place. More to the point, as that example illustrates amply, this whole debate kicks up a host of issues that are meat and drink for Reading Our Times. You can't talk about colonial reparations without working through what you think about moral responsibility, about collective identity, about the effect of time on liability, all of which reflect on the underlying question of how we see ourselves. All these topics and more come to the surface in a short, punchy, and admirably clear new book on the subject by Michael Banner. Michael is a Christian ethicist and Dean and Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, and has written books on bioethics, science, and public policy. And his latest book that we're discussing this week is entitled Britain's Slavery Debt, Reparations Now. Michael, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thanks for having me to talk to.
We are becoming better acquainted with the horrors of colonial slavery and the transatlantic slave trade, but no discussion of reparations can begin without touching on the true scale and the wickedness of that endeavour. Can you give us some idea of what we're talking about here?
I mean, the headline figure, which I think is probably best to start with, is that something around, I mean, one can't be very accurate, but something around 12.5 million people thereabouts, it was estimated, were forcibly moved from Africa, West Africa, to the Americas, North and South, and the Caribbean in particular. Britain itself was responsible for transporting forcibly something like 3 million, maybe a bit more than 3 million people. But anyway, we're talking, you know, 12.5 million people in the context of a world with a smaller population than we have now. So it really constitutes one of the great racial crimes of the last period alongside the Holocaust.
And it begins with Portugal in the 16th century, but Britain gets in on the act by about the mid-17th century, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Britain does some this privateering, as they called it, in the late Elizabethan period. People used to be big heroes, I guess, when Britain celebrated its early Elizabethan sailors. They would steal Spanish vessels with, and if they found them with slaves on, they'd sell the slaves somewhere else and move on. But Britain started taking it up seriously in the 1630s, 40s. And of course, by the early 1700s, we are the premier slaving nation in the world. And for about I guess for close on 100 years, we are. And Liverpool is the world's leading slaving port, having overtaken Bristol. So we're up there with the leaders as a major contributor to that 12.5 million.
Yeah. And it's important to emphasise that that 12.5 million is not just sort of abducted and transported and then forced into a life of labour, but that life of labour is regularly graced with physical punishment, with rape, with torture. It's truly awful.
It's truly awful. I mean, I spoke somewhere recently and someone said afterwards that they found it very traumatic. And I said, well, you know, I apologize. You know, you didn't know I was going to talk about this in detail. And I should have said that this is a traumatic subject, but there is no way of talking about it which is not traumatic. And the shorthand way of saying it, we use the word plantation, but actually, if we really want to call them what they were slave labor death camps. Slave labor in the sense, well, that's what they were. You went to labor, but death camps in that we know from letters that existed, we know from the figures, we know from the data. Then in the 1760s, 1770s, 1780s, plantation owners consciously took the decision that it was better to work slaves to death and buy new slaves than it was to try and maintain the populations. Even the Archbishop of Canterbury sits in on a meeting of the United Society, whatever it was called in those days, the society that owned a plantation in Barbados, the Codrington plantation. And his line of questioning is, why are we buying more slaves? And the subtext of that is, why aren't they reproducing themselves? And the reason they weren't reproducing themselves is they were being worked and starved into early deaths and replaced. Mm-hmm. So it is difficult to get your head around the horrors of this. The Middle Passage is what we've often concentrated on. That was truly terrible. But what preceded it, the kidnap, the march to the coast, the violence of capture, and what followed it, the life on the plantation, being split up from any kin group that may have been maintained on a ship, any friendships that you may have made on a ship, being separated at the point of sale in the Caribbean, and then the life that followed. It's all horrific from beginning to end.
Yeah. Now, one of the dates that's probably the only date that lives in the popular imagination in this whole story is 1807, when the transatlantic slave trade is abolished by Britain, but it's not slavery. Slavery continues in British, quote-unquote, plantations for another 30 or so years, doesn't it?
That's right. So abolition of slavery itself follows nearly 30 years later. And of course, there was still some movement of slaves between British colonies, but the transatlantic slave trade, at least as far as Britain was concerned, came to an end. And Britain, as some people make a big deal of, and it needs mentioning, Britain invested some money and material and resources after the abolition of the trade in trying to suppress the trade across the world. The Royal Navy was involved in that.
Yeah. And pivotal to your particular argument is that when slavery was abolished in British colonies in 1834, it was the slave owners who were compensated to the amount of about £20 million, yes?
Yeah, £20 million in money of those days was the amount set aside by the British government to compensate slave owners. It's important to recognise that that was controversial at the time. Some of the heroes of the abolition movement, like Clarkson and others, argued that the money was owed to other people, the enslaved, not to the enslavers, and there shouldn't be compensation. People shouldn't be compensated for what was a crime in the language of the abolitionists. But politically, there was no way abolition would have gone through had there not been compensation. And this sum of 20 million is a vast, vast sum if we look at it in modern terms.
Mm. And it's worth emphasising as well, it wouldn't have gone through politically, not simply because the plantation owners would have kicked up an enormous fuss and resisted in any way possible, but because it would have set a precedent for what many people would have considered the appropriation of private property, which in the political economy of the early 19th century was absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah, I think there's a very clever political strategy, as I understand it, that the slave owners allied themselves, rather than talking about slaves, enslaved people, they talked about property, and they formed an alliance in effect with people who owned land and people who owned other goods. So there was worries about railways coming on, you know, government projects that might involve the confiscation of land. So they allied themselves very closely with a property interest. One might have said, this is not like normal property. It should never have been property. One could have imagined that argument. But they played a clever game and they found a lot of allies, as you say, Nick, amongst people who were worried about the power of government and the power of government to interfere in private property.
There's a great book by Boyd Hilton talking about the Age of Atonement and the way in which Christian theology influenced political economy at the beginning of the 19th century. And it was considered to be against, not just against nature, but against God's will to interfere with individual property and individual moral incentives, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're probably right. I think to later generations of Christian thought, that seems slightly astonishing, but you're absolutely right. That was the argument that weighed heavily with people in those days.
Mm. Now, there can't be a single normal person who doesn't feel physically sick at the scale and nature of all this. But your argument is that that can only be the foundation of a response. Our response shouldn't end there. And your fundamental case for reparation draws a lot on the idea of moral repair and the work of Margaret Walker. Tell us what moral repair is.
So moral repair, it can sound quite fancy, but in fact, I think it's a very simple idea and concept. I would say that we all know roughly what to do when we've done something wrong. So, Nick, let's take something trivial. Even if you'd invited me on this program and I hadn't turned up, and it wasn't until a day later I'd realised. I know that what I've got to do, I've got to ring you up. I've got to say, Nick, I'm sorry I did that. You must have been very inconvenienced. That's really bad of me. And can I make it up to you by? So it's about acknowledging you've done something wrong, saying what it is you've done wrong. It's apologising for it, saying I'm very sorry I caused you that harm, and typically doing something about it. And it could be symbolic and trivial, giving a bunch of flowers. And we know how that would look if it was a hospital that's been negligent. If a hospital, I've gone to a hospital and had a treatment that should have gone well and it didn't and it went wrong. Again, we know what that looks like. My argument is, you know, this is familiar ground and harm has been done, the harm of slavery and colonialism. We are the continuing beneficiaries of slavery and colonialism. So we have benefited from it. There are still people in the Caribbean who are suffering as a result of that. And what we should do is quite simple. Three things. We need to acknowledge the wrong, show that we know what harms have been caused. We need to apologize for it in a variety of ways, possibly. And we need to do something. If I say to put it right, I don't mean to wipe it away, but we need to do something which constitutes a recognition of the harm that's being suffered and admitting that there's something we can and should do to try and put that right.
Mm. So there's three important dimensions there. There's acknowledging the wrong, and also you draw out in the book that involves attentive listening to the wronged party. There's the apology, and there's some form of amendment. Your argument is that needs to be the basis of the British response to colonial slavery in the Caribbean. But as you are acutely aware, not everyone, to put it mildly, sees it the same way. And so by far and away, the longest chapter in the book is your response to people's objections to the idea of reparations. Now, I think there are something like 11 in total. Too many for us to dwell on each individually, but I want to group some of them into broad themes and draw out some of the underlying moral logic of the argument here, because I found this really, really interesting. Two of your objections, I think, are very closely related around what we might call moral cognizance. Namely, that people thought that slavery was morally acceptable back then, and also people thought it was legal back then, and therefore reparations aren't owed. Now, the first thing to say in response to this, and you make this point, is that when it comes to people not thinking that slavery was morally wrong, that wasn't the case, was it?
Not uniformly. It's not as if everyone thought it was okay. George Fox, Quaker, goes to Barbados in the middle, endish of the 17th century, very early when Britain's newly in the Caribbean, newly establishing sugar plantations. And he condemns, people say he doesn't condemn slavery outright, but he certainly condemns the slavery witnesses right up to 1800. In fact, you can say that by 1780, thereabouts, no one is making an in-principle defence of slavery. People say things like, well, slavery exists and it can't go away immediately. We've got to prepare people for freedom. But no one by 1780 is really making an in-principle defence of slavery. And yet slavery exists for another 50 years. What's very significant is that many plantation owners, many enslavers in the Caribbean, they'd go out to the Caribbean young. They'd hope to come back to Britain and make an advantageous marriage. Meanwhile, they would take from their slaves women as concubines, common law wives, whatever term you want to use. Now, occasionally, quite rarely, relatively, but occasionally they would acknowledge the children of these marriages. And one of the things they'd often do on their deaths is to free, manumit those children. They'd give them their freedom. This is a symbol to me that fathers knew very well that slavery was not okay. If what you did with your illegitimate children, their natural children, as they called them in those days, was to free them, was it just because you knew that slavery was intolerable and you didn't want your sons and daughters even ones you weren't prepared to render legitimate. You didn't want them to experience the horrors of slavery. So I think we can talk about what argument was going on, but actually the actions of people, which speak loudly to the fact that they understood very well what was wrong with slavery.
I'm really interested in this sense of the basis of their understanding that slavery was wrong. There's a large part of me would like to say there are some crimes that are so viscerally nauseating, such as the enslavement and brutalisation of other human beings, that we can say they are obviously wrong. There's almost like a natural law element to this. But the brute fact is that slavery has been the norm in most societies throughout most of history. And I wonder then, is this cognizance of the wrongness of slavery that slowly emerges in the 18th century? What causes that? Where do those sensibilities develop? How do they develop?
It's a very interesting question. People often associate it with two forces, the beginning of the Enlightenment and the rise of evangelicalism. And both of those traditions, quite different, we often oppose them, but they seem to me to have one thing in common. Just as the rights of man is a sort of slogan from the Enlightenment, a sense of the rights of individuals, it marries in a certain way with the rise of an evangelical sensibility, which places the responsibility of the individual Christian and the destiny of every Christian and their being individuals in the sight of God. So that a sort of individualism that's developing, a consciousness of individual rights, seems to me the background sensibility which in different ways is coming together at the end of the 18th century. I think you're absolutely right, Nick, to mention the natural law element. I think from my argument, it's sufficient to trouble the simple thought that everyone thought slavery was okay. I'm doing some work at the moment looking at slavers from Liverpool at the end of the 18th and into the early 19th century. And what's significant is how many of them, they just don't want their children being slavers. I mean, their ambition is to establish their children somewhere else. And that's partly social climbing, because slavery was a trade and a trade that everyone looked down on. So you'd rather your kids, your sons were barristers or clergymen or soldiers or whatever. But I can't help also thinking it was a vile, vile thing to be involved in. And they knew that it was. And even if you somehow justified it, I find it very difficult to see that you could actually think that the realities of it, the deaths, the pain, the violence, was anything other than, even if we just call it unpleasant, let alone anything stronger than that.
I wonder also whether there is just slowly seeping into the wider public awareness a cognizance of quite how brutal this is. I mean, I'm struck by parallels to ordinary Germans' defence of their stances in the 1930s, or their lack of stance against Germany. And it was the just, we just didn't know argument. Now, there's been a huge amount of historical debate about the extent to which they didn't know. But I wonder whether that comes into play in this whole moral debate as well, whereas Britons in the early part of the 18th century could, some of them at least, legitimately say, we didn't know. Whereas by the end of the 18th century, everybody knew.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and it's very difficult for us with our engagement with mass media. Even a man of my age, older than you, Nick, as a kid growing up with newspapers, televisions, daily diet of pictures and what a story is about everything. That's obviously not the case in the 18th and even through into the early 19th century. And there are two particular ships. One becomes famous by name and one becomes famous in an image. The one is the Zong, where the master of the ship decided to throw overboard something like 230 enslaved people as they approached Jamaica. But for reasons simply so that they could claim on insurance, they threw overboard 230 live slaves. That became a notorious case because the insurers declined to pay the insurance and the slave ship owners went to court. We probably would never have heard of the case if the insurers had paid up, but it became a celebrated case just because it went through the courts. The other ship that no one knows so well by name, but everyone knows the image, is the Brooks. If you've ever seen an image of how a slave ship was loaded, it's very likely an image of the Brooks, which was a Liverpool ship from the 1780s. It often sailed with nearly twice as many people as that image we see of the bodies laying side by side, as if in a large coffin, 300 or more enslaved people lined shoulder to shoulder. That image was used by abolitionists and became celebrated. And those two together, as you say, Nick, changed what people knew. So that by 1800, you'd heard of the Zong and you knew the image of the Brooks. And you couldn't say anything other than this is intolerable.
So publicity and getting people aware of actually what was happening is highly relevant to this debate. There's a second area where these different objections to reparations come together. The two objections I'm thinking about here are the one that it's a long time ago and it's time to move on, and the second one, which is what about the Vikings or the Barbary parents? It seems to me that the essence of both of those objections pertains to the question of time. So I guess the first question in this part of the discussion is, to what extent do you think time actually does alter the nature of the kind of moral claims we're talking about?
Ideally, you would say time would wash away the claims. They'd render them seemingly absurd because things had changed so much that the claim would seem, you know, slightly superfluous. Imagine, Nick, we'd met 20 years ago and I'd trodden on your toes. If 20 years later you asked me to apologise, I probably would, but I think, come on, Nick, it's 20 years ago, you know? Time heals all is a phrase we have. And, you know, it's a long time ago. Let bygones be bygones. We say all these things. What's special about the case we're discussing is one of the things I've been saying to people recently when I've talked about this is abolition wasn't really abolition. We abolished slavery legally speaking. There were no more slaves in the British Empire after 1833, 1834. But we found ways of maintaining servitude in the Caribbean colonies such that through until the early 1900s, we did not have what you'd call a fully emancipated population granted civil, legal, and general social rights. So the Caribbean was a bit like America in the 60s through into the 70s when civil rights were still a live issue. There were no civil rights as we would understand them in the Caribbean in the colonial period. And the poverty that colonialism and enslavement brought to the Caribbean is still being suffered now as a result of our actions. So it's a long time ago, sure, but the long consequences of those harms are still being suffered by present generations. And we are still the beneficiaries. Now, if you mentioned the Vikings, and people always ask me about the Vikings and Barbary pirates. I don't mind. We can talk about them. They're a bad lot, I'm sure. But it's not clear to me that we could identify a population who are the inheritors of the plunder that the Vikings took, or people who now suffer as a result of their actions. That's not the case with Britain and the Caribbean. We are the beneficiaries. They are the continuing sufferers from the actions of the British people.
So let me push back on that point. I do understand the what about the Vikings thing can often seem like a, dare I say it, bit of a Daily Mail cliche. But you say at one point that it's going to be distinctly tricky to hold either the Vikings or the Barbary pirates to account anytime soon. That's essentially a pragmatic response. This is really difficult. We're talking even further long ago. It's even harder to pinpoint who the moral monsters were. And so it's not going to happen. But we're talking about the principle of reparations, the principle of moral repair. And one might mount the argument, well, you know, Scandinavia is an extraordinarily ethnically homogeneous place in Europe. There's a very good indication that a large number of people who are resident in Norway at the moment are actually direct descendants from the Vikings and so on and so forth. So you shouldn't really put a pragmatic defence to what is actually a principled claim.
I'm happy to object in principle as well. But why not the Vikings, if you want a principle argument? You make the point about ethnically homogeneous. Maybe so, I don't know, but let's grant it for a minute. I think the important point is Britain is politically, socially, and economically a continuation from the 19th century. There's been no major social, political, economic upheaval which separates us from our ancestors of 300 years ago. I don't know about your family, Nick, and I don't know about my family in detail, but I suspect I could trace my family back 200 or 300 years, and we've been doing boring, dull things for a long time. We're still here. That doesn't work after a certain time just because you can't make the connections. But we are economically, socially, politically, in a certain sense, the same people. We're the inheritors of those people in a manifest sense.
Well, that's a very good bridge to my third area, which is that of collective moral agency, the meaning of that little word we, which you talk about at one point. Now, I mentioned in my introduction how it would be grotesquely hypocritical of the British to have pride at the abolition movement without also feeling shame at the slavery that made the abolition movement necessary in the first place. And let's be honest with you, that's pretty much where we were in 2007. But that does bring up this question of how thick that sense of collective moral agency is. One of the objections you counter at this point in the book is that intergenerational reparations amount to the visiting of the sins of the fathers on their sons. And you say that A, it's not morally defensible to visit the sins of the fathers on their sons, but B, that's not what reparations is. Unpack that for us.
Nick, you're putting your finger on, I think, an important thing. And I sort of want to say two things. I want to say that reparations is really about, to use another word, it's about restitution. So that if a picture turns up from a bank vault in Europe, and it was last known in a collection of, let's say, a Jewish family in Vienna, and it was bought for a song under forced circumstances, we know that picture will go back. All being well, we'll go back to the descendants of that family. Not a defense to say it came to me honestly and decently. You don't lose title in a picture by having it stolen. So if you're the person who bought it five times down the line, you still have to return it. So it's about restitution. And the person who returns the picture is not being punished. They're just having to give it back. So I want to say that. So I want to take away some of the sins of the father's stuff. On the other hand, I want to say, I do think that if I, as a Briton, a British Briton, as it were, with roots here for as long as I know, if I don't feel some sense of responsibility, it seems to me I'm slightly morally clueless. In other words, if the descendants of the Nazi commandant who stole the picture don't feel a little bit ashamed, a little bit embarrassed, troubled, I mean, what word am I looking for here? A little bit that they might want to say sorry to the grandchildren of the people whose picture was taken. I'm not sure I could persuade them they were wrong, but I think I'd feel they were a bit morally flat-footed. Mm. I mean, if my great-granddad stole your people's land or property and you'd suffered, of course I shouldn't be punished for that. I didn't do it. But if I don't feel some compunction, what word am I looking for, Nick? Some responsibility? It's not responsibility in the sense punish me, but am I not a little bit ashamed? You know, my people did that to your people.
Well, I'm fascinated by this. I can't put my finger on the word, but perhaps because I feel a very similar thing. I've been thinking about this, and, you know, in response to your question to me, where does my family come from? Well, as it happens, my family comes from all over the place. Some of them are German, yeah. Some of them are Greek, but actually some of them are from the Northwest, and I have had relatives live in Liverpool, so it's not impossible at all. It's not impossible at all that somewhere 100 years or so before the earliest relatives of whom I know, there was some kind of connection there. Now, were I to discover that, you know, my great-great-great etc. grandfather were a slaver, what would I feel? That's right, I'd feel revulsion. I'd feel shame. But then I think to myself, well, what am I, Nick Spencer, feeling that for? I feel disgusted at the actions of my putative great-great-great-grandfather. But if I were to say I'm sorry for that, there's a part of me would think, actually, that's a really hollow apology because I'm not apologising for anything that I genuinely think I'm morally culpable for. I'm apologising for some kind of guilt by association. But that's a pretty thin kind of guilt, isn't it?
It could be, and I'm not even wanting to argue that you should or shouldn't. I think, however, the example I gave, if I imagine that my great-grandfather had deprived your great-grandfather of property so that the subsequent generations had suffered as a result, and maybe you'd suffered, I didn't do it, but our sense of association and being part of a family and our sense of ownership in those actions is such that just to say, I think we're struggling, it's right we're struggling because it's not clear to us, but I think what is clear to me is just to say nothing to do with me is not enough. Nick, you're saying what we say we'd have to think about for it to be genuine and honest rather than simply cheap and trivial. I suppose all I'm saying is it would be cheap and trivial in another way, I think, to say nothing to do with me. So we're looking for the ground, and I think it is difficult. Talked earlier about the simple case where I failed to make an appointment with you. That's very obvious and simple to us. These cases are further out. Yep. We know we're in the same territory, but we're stumbling a little bit. And that's why I think these arguments can get so difficult.
Well, it's because this is such a demanding conversation that it's so interesting and so fruitful. And I'm deeply attracted to this idea of moral repair, not least because immediate interactions between agents who are morally cognizant and rational and so on and so forth, you see how it works. But then you start stripping away some of these elements and time gets built into it and this collective moral agency and the attenuated sense of us-ness comes into it and it starts getting stretched. And I think part of the tension here is that the three or four dimensions of moral repair that you set out right at the beginning are comprehensive and very attractive. And several times in the book, you make the point about coming into possession of stolen goods unknowingly. You return stolen goods. That's what happens. And in that regard, if we frame colonial slavery and reparations in that way, there's a very strong justification for some form of amendment being made. But as the moral repair argument has it, some form of amendment isn't enough. That's blood money, effectively. That's stop hassling me if I give you the cash. Moral repair demands apology as well. And getting that kind of apology from somebody who is actually just returning stolen goods, as it were, seems harder. It seems to me that there is a tension in all this between the need to make some form of material amendment in order to achieve moral repair and the apology that is also involved in that.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a tension. And I've wanted to say two things. If we think about the case in a simple way, like a stolen bike, my bike was stolen, it was sold to three or four people. You've got my bike, the police find it, they give it back to me. You bought it in good faith from someone. I don't expect you particularly to apologize to me. You bought it from someone in good faith. I've got my bike back. You won't be punished. So that's the simple restitution case. We, I think, are the possessors of property and well-being and wealth and goods which really belonged in the Caribbean rather than coming to Britain in 1834. However, I think that's too simple. I think that works as an argument, but you're right, I want to get an apology element in. The people of the Caribbean look for and expect an apology. And I think that's right, and that's because there's a sense in which not to feel responsible for our past is to alienate ourselves from a past in a way which is actually quite foreign to us. So we often feel pride for things that are British. We feel pride for our political traditions, for our heritage, for our culture, for Shakespeare, for paintings, for whatever it is. We feel pride. We can feel pride in our schools, our families, all sorts of things for which we're not responsible. The flip side of that is if we can feel pride, we ought to be able to feel shame as well. And I think one can feel shame for what my people did to your people, these other people, we can feel shame at that while thinking it's not the right modality to say we should be punished.
Yeah.
But finding the ground, finding the way of expressing this is, I think, difficult, which is why the arguments are often so tense and problematic.
It's a very powerful point there, in that, in a sense, you either feel both or you feel neither. You can't claim to feel pride at all the wonderful things that Britain has given to the world and feel no connection whatsoever to the various shameful things. I think that is a very, very powerful case.
Yeah, you kind of pick and mix.
Pick and mix. According to the stuff that you like, it's according to stuff you want to be associated with. As you say, not an Englishman alive who's not proud of Shakespeare, despite the fact that not an Englishman alive has got a single connection to Shakespeare like that. But I'm glad we're homing in on this question of the thickness of our collective moral responsibility, because it seems to me this is a really key issue here. And there's another dimension to it as well, which is picking up on the phrase you used a minute ago, which is we are possessors of wealth that was drawn from extractive colonialism in the Caribbean. One of the mainstays of the argument here, and it's a hugely contentious historical debate, the extent to which Britain's Industrial Revolution was catalysed, fed, enabled by extractive colonialism. And there are some who say the impact was negligible. There are others who famously say colonialism underpinned the Industrial Revolution. And I think you mentioned at one point in the book, there's nothing like a consensus here, but some people are saying, you know, 10% of Britain's economic growth over that period of time can be put down somewhere or other to the boost from extractive colonialism. Now, here's the point I want to make about that. Life expectancy in Birmingham around the time of the abolition of slavery was about 36. In Manchester and Liverpool, it was about 29 or so. At the time of the New Poor Law, somewhere between 40 to 50% of Britons were living in extreme poverty. There were, I think it's right saying, 46,000 slave owners who claimed compensation as a result of the abolition in the 1830s. That's obviously a massive underestimate of the number of people who benefited from slavery. But either way, that's going to number in the hundreds of thousands. And it seems to me there's a danger of a fundamental injustice going on here, whereby the 15 or so million people that lived in urban slums who didn't benefit from the Industrial Revolution are still fingered with the responsibility for paying colonial reparations. Do you see what I mean?
It's a good question. And I think one needs to think carefully about how Britain made reparations, how they would be made, so that one doesn't correct a past injustice by causing a present one. And you've put your finger on it, I guess, by saying it was the British worker who paid that enormous, in those days, enormous sum of 20 million that came out of the British exchequer, which came from the British population in effect. So we lined the pockets of the very wealthy, typically, and the poor paid. So I think it's important that if we look at reparations now, we don't replicate that. And not a great detail, but I mentioned that one should think about what a wealth tax would look like as a way of funding reparations. But I'm looking at families of particularly slave traders from Liverpool at the end of the 18th century. And I'm interested how down the generations, the money flows. And one can't do this forensically. It's not like you can look at a bank account and see who spent what and whatever. You just see that the money is, say, the first generation, it's buying a living for one of the clerical kid. It's buying a commission in the army for another one. It's setting a daughter up with a marriage with the son of an earl, and so on. And you see it down the generations. You can follow the generations down. Money is sticky in this country. It always has been. And I'm not going to name names, but you can trace families, well-known aristocratic families today. You can find a grandfather of the generation from 1838 and 4. The grandfather was a simple slave trader. Money is sticky in nations, and it's sticky within nations. And we need to find a way, if we are to do reparations, of recognizing that fact and not imposing the costs of putting right an injustice from the past on those who don't have the money.
Yeah. And that's why I'd say that the wealth tax idea that you introduced briefly at the end, I think, is very important in all this. Thomas Piketty was one of our early interviews in an earlier series of Reading Our Times, and his book Behind Me on the Shelf, Capital and Capital Ideology, are superb. And he goes into a lot of detail about what a wealth tax might look like there. And the advantage of that as a basis of reparations is that you're basically taking people who've got it rather than taxpayers. So that is a way forward. But let me put one other objection to this, which, again, you touch on in the book. You say several times that the principle of reparations, if you go back 100 years or so, is not a happy one. We know what happened in 1919. We know what happened in Versailles. We know the imposition of reparations and what it did with Germany. It seems to me that actually the issue there was not so much the imposition of reparations on Germany, but the overwhelming sense that so many Germans had that the imposition of reparations was unfair. Mm. And there's nothing quite as effective as stirring up extreme nationalistic and resentful fervour than the sense that you have endured a wrong. Now, this is a slightly perverse way of asking this, because in this whole debate, there is one group of people who endured a wrong, and it isn't the British, right? Mm. But is there not a risk, to pick up from your subtitle, Reparations Now, if the government were to make a gesture like this, it would breed a level of resentment that would lead us to an unhappy place, shall we say?
Well, would it? I think it's obviously not the sort of thing that happens with a flick of a pen. Someone doesn't just sit down in Whitehall and write a check, if anyone writes checks these days. It wouldn't be like that. It involves a lot of discussion. I think the point about reparations is they've got to be negotiated, and there's a negotiation on both sides. I'm responding to a particular case that has been made and addressing it, the case that's been made by CARICOM, the Caribbean nations, and they don't actually mention the sum. So they don't mention the sum of money. And our conversations about reparations often fix on money, but the CARICOM proposal involves a lot of other things around cultural appreciation of the wrongs, repatriation, all sorts of things get discussed as part of what acknowledging the wrongs would look like. Money would be one part of it. I think part of those discussions would be preparing people for understanding both the horrors of what happened, the suffering of people in the Caribbean, the present poverty there, how effective reparations could be in addressing that. So I think there's a conversation way down the line. But I think if someone wrote a check tomorrow, there could be a lot of resentment.
Yeah. One of the many strengths of the book is that you're not afraid to roll your sleeves up and talk about figures, but our conversation has mainly focused on the moral contours of that debate, because that's what interests me, and I think that's close to the heart of Reading Our Times. I often end conversations with authors with the question of, what does what we've been talking about say to us about the human condition, about our understanding of who we are and what our responsibilities are and what our failures are and what our glories are? What's your response to that? What's to say about who we are?
I think, Nick, this book is a very personal book for me. I mean, someone read it and said to me, you're like a lawyer, I'm like making a case. It's a very sort of bang, 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 you know. I'm setting out the logic of a case for reparations, what it looks like, the objections to it. But for me, I think it's quite personal, because I think I grew up in a racist Britain, born in 1961. Racism is the flavour of conversations I grew up with politics. Enoch Powell was the most popular politician of his day in the 70s when I was coming into consciousness about these things. And I think it's only dawned on me quite recently after a whole career, you know, 35 years or more of teaching ethics, that I've never, ever, in my academic work or in teaching, I've never, ever addressed racism. And what we're talking about, slavery is, some people used to think racism led to slavery. The most popular thesis these days, and I think the right one, is that it was slavery that led to racism in the form we know it. So for me, this is a, feels quite a personal thing, coming to terms with this aspect of my past, but leading to a consciousness of what happened, which I think is a consciousness we all need to share if we're to address the continuing wrongs of racism as they affect the world today.
The book is called Britain's Slavery Debt, Reparations Now. Michael Banner, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be speaking to historian Jonathan Clarke about what, if anything, the Enlightenment was and what it means to us today.
I think this takes us to the heart of my answer, that there is no one thing called the human condition. Why should there not be as many human conditions as there are human beings?
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.